Good morning, everyone. You guys look very stoic, so hopefully I'll make the presentation healthy and exciting for everyone. Thank you for coming. It is Monday morning, and I'm happy to see that our crowds have gotten progressively larger as the morning has gone later. I'll be talking about some research that I participated in for 1 month last summer in the Central Asian Republic of Tajikistan. And as I said, my name is Jing. I'm a third-year med student. I'm really happy that the APHA actually has asked all our presenters to give a slide about disclosures. I personally have no relationship, just like all our previous speakers, although I think I almost ate a slice of pizza that was sponsored by a drug rep about a month ago. But I did not. I stopped myself. Honestly, though, I'm a member of the American Medical Students Association, and unlike other professional organizations, in 2000 we decided to eschew all pharmaceutical funding, and that was quite difficult for us. And I'm also a member of the Farm Free Movement, which is a part of our organization's group. And in regards to this issue about taking money from pharmaceutical companies, I think it's very important for us in the public health field to be thinking about, not just for physicians and physicians in training, that's a conflict of interest issue. I think it's a much broader issue. It's also about access to essential medicines, it's about a lot of different things. And for us to be, I think it's very important for us as professionals to, you know, kind of maintain our autonomy and our scientific, you know, integrity. And I don't know if you guys went to the International AIDS Conference in Mexico City, but I was quite surprised to find a lot of other, you know, pharmaceutical companies that were participating in there with huge million-dollar booths and exhibitions. I'm sure, you know, I questioned the ethics of that, so I'm proud that APHA has talked about disclosures. Okay, on to the substance of my discussion. Learning objectives, I'd like to discuss how migration shapes HIV risk. I'd like to identify three conditions of the social environment that contribute to increased HIV risk among internal and external migrants. And we'll talk about an intervention at the very end that we've tried to introduce to reduce the risk of HIV in the context of migration specifically. So the Central Asian Republic of Tajikistan is actually one of the poorest of the Central Asian Republics. There's about, the population's around 7 million. And of those 7 million, about 1 million people are thought to be migrant workers. There was a huge civil war in Tajikistan back in 1995, in which about 50,000 people were thought to have killed, and it devastated their economy as well as their healthcare infrastructure. And as a result, many men in Tajikistan migrate to other parts of the former Soviet Union in order to look for work. For example, they go to Moscow or to Kazakhstan. And here's, I mean, I'll present a lot of pictures just to be a little more interesting. This is a village outside of Iskandakur Lake in Tajikistan. And as you can see, the region is very mountainous. About 93% of the country of Tajikistan is a mountainous region. And most of their economy either comes from the drug trade, which is opiate products that come up through Afghanistan. And they also have a large aluminum factory in the western portion of the country, which is part of where we did some of our research at. Previous studies have shown that labor migration is a large contributor for HIV risk. As I said before, in Tajikistan, about 1 in 5 males are labor migrants, and they travel to Moscow or other Central Asian republics to look for work. And while in Moscow, we found that Tajik migrants face unsafe living conditions and as well as discrimination and beatings from police and other groups. Migrants also engage in high-risk sexual behaviors, such as concurrent sex with sex workers, and these sex workers in other studies have been shown to have an estimated HIV prevalence that's 30 to 120 times higher than that of Moscow's general population. So they're at high risk. We also looked at studies from Catherine Campbell in South Africa, and she did studies on migrant mine workers in the South African mines, and she found that amidst those dangerous and harsh living and working conditions, men experienced this sense of powerlessness over protecting themselves. They had lower self-efficacy in HIV protection, and they generally thought that if they're the you know, the risk of dying was so immediate from working in these dangerous conditions that they didn't need to protect themselves from having sex with the prostitutes by using condoms and other things. And to investigate the role of powerlessness in labor migrants, we compared migrant workers from Tajikistan who migrate to Moscow. We term those people external migrants with those that work within Tajikistan. So they've migrated from one region or one village to another region in order to look for work. And we call those people internal migrants. So the two groups that we looked at were the external migrants that left on the train from Dushanbe to Moscow, or there's a flight also. Or the separate group, the internal migrants, were those who worked at an aluminum factory in the province of Raigarh in the western portion of the country. It's probably the largest aluminum factory in all of Central Asia, and it was established from the old Soviet times, and there's probably about 30,000 people that work at that specific factory. And the questions that we had was, do internal and external migrants have similar HIV risk and preventative behaviors? And if there are differences, can those differences be explained by this powerlessness that I discussed earlier, or is there some other explanation? And this is a qualitative study. So methods, we used minimally structured interviews and focused field observations with 30 married male internal migrants in Raigarh and 30 married external migrants that we also talked to in Dushanbe. And these transcripts and interviews were coded and analyzed using Atlas TI. So briefly about the demographics, external migrants were usually slightly younger. They range from 18 to 45. So they started younger in the sense that if they just came out of high school, a lot of them would migrate to Moscow to look for work. The internal migrants are usually older. They're at least 25 or older. They had professional degrees. They had training in like, you know, metalwork or chemistry or something like that. External migrants had variable education. A lot of them came straight out of high school. And the internal migrants often had technical degrees. They had been trained in Russia during the old Soviet Union times. Both groups of men were married. They had Tajik wives, but we found also that both external migrants and internal migrants had extramarital relationships, sexual relationships. The external migrants usually had a girlfriend or a wife in Moscow while they were immigrating between Tajikistan and Russia, and the internal migrants often also had girlfriends in Raigarh. If they had been living in Raigarh for many years, more than 2 years or so, we found that there was an increased rate of having a wife there as well, a second wife. And the external migrants obviously make a lot more money. They earn about $400,000 per month compared to internal migrants who work at the aluminum factory. They earned about $100 to $300 a month. So the differences in social environment were first that external migrants were, we collectively deemed them as being unprotected by the law, whereas internal migrants were registered workers in their own country. They were able to freely move around to, you know, do as they wish, whereas also the external migrants had unsafe living conditions, whereas the internal migrants lived in safe dormitories with one and three others. These dorms were kind of like old Soviet-style barracks that were funded, you know, they were paid for by the large aluminum factory there in Raigarh. And we also found that external migrants joined peer networks, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. So the external migrants we found were unprotected by law, and I'll present some quotes to help, you know, emphasize my points, and they might have grammatical errors when you read them because they were transcribed by some of our ethnographers in Tajikistan who, you know, obviously English is not their first language. And we didn't want to change any of those. So some migrants who emigrated to Moscow said these, if Russians want to kill you, beat you, say whatever words they want, a Tajik does not have the right to say a simple word. Tajiks are unprotected. Another said, I saw myself as a skin of a slave in Moscow. We are unprotected. In terms of the unsafe living conditions, one migrant said that, yes, we're living 10 persons in one room, and it's, you know, a pretty small place to live together, but we're all managing. It's difficult to find a room for rent in Moscow because if you're a migrant, you can't be trusted, and also the living expenses are quite expensive in Moscow. Another said that we are 50 people living in one camp. The conditions are terrible. There's not any ventilation system, and it's very difficult to breathe. We do not have a bed even. So a lot of the migrants in Tajikistan, when they go to Russia, they work in like construction sites or they work in the bazaars, and they often live together for support. And they also join peer networks. One said that no one can survive alone in this terrible society. You have to belong to a network. Okay, so here's the stuff I guess you guys are interested in. HIV, AIDS knowledge, sexual behavior, and condom use. So among external migrants and internal migrants, we found that they had variable HIV knowledge. No one was able to clearly, there were very few people that were able to clearly articulate the three ways that, you know, HIV can be spread or ways to prevent HIV. But they did have some knowledge that it was kind of a dangerous disease that they wanted, they did not want to catch it. External migrants, recently, in like last year, I think, Russia passed a new law in which migrants from Tajikistan were forced to first get tested to get kind of a badge or an ID from their home country, which says that they had been tested negative for HIV before they could enter the country. And for internal migrants, many migrants reported that testing was available but often not utilized. And lastly, while the internal migrants don't really accept or realize the increased risk for HIV in Russia, internal migrants, they also did not see HIV as too huge of a problem in Tajikistan, even though previous studies have shown that Eastern Europe is the fastest rising rates of HIV. So here's a photo from the Dushanbe Republican HIV AIDS Center, which is where a lot of the AIDS testing, the HIV testing was being conducted before they left. And if you see here, they show these are rapid HIV tests, finger stick tests, and these are all negative, and these two over here with the two red stripes were positive or possibly positive. So for HIV and AIDS knowledge, an external migrant says that everyone says that HIV is dangerous, but no one changes his behavior. Even me, I'm having sex with prostitutes and don't use a condom because knowing is different from doing. The internal migrants said that, I heard that there's a dangerous disease called AIDS. It's transferred by sexual contacts or if someone doesn't use a condom, but I think this disease is very less in Tajikistan. For sexual behavior, we found that external migrants had multiple concurrent sex with sex workers, whereas internal migrants were more likely to have sex workers through Mama Rosa, which is kind of like this madam or pimptress that would organize the informal sexual networks in the Raigar province. External migrants often had heavy alcohol use, whereas internal migrants utilized individual decision making with regards to selecting sex workers. And I'll show some quotes to prove that. And the similarities were that among Tajik society was that men were expected to have sex with other women when they were away from the wives or homes. Oops. So here's some quotes from external migrants about their sexual behavior. As you can see, they talk about having sex with one girl who would cost maybe like 200, I don't think those are dollars, someone is, or maybe it was in Russian currency. And they were 20 guys that were living in the same housing, so they agreed to sleep with her, then each of them would, you know, pay her like 10 equivalent currency. They also said things that that sex workers are having, you know, many partners. This guy says that they have 10 to 20 sexual partners a night. What else did they say? And at the very bottom, they talk about having to exchange their women during the sexual acts. Whereas internal migrants, we found that they had sex workers mostly through this madam called Mama Rosa, and they discussed having three different types of sex workers in the province of Raigar: those who stay in cafes or restaurants, those who work independently and were more expensive, and the last group is those who work through Mama Rosa. The sexual networks there were more informal. They were through cellular phone networks. They were able to get the phone numbers from, you know, one girl, and then that girl would then give numbers for other of their friends or colleagues. And this is just a nightclub that when I was there, and these are some sex workers that I had met. Okay, so lastly, I want to talk about condom use. Both groups thought that you can't really take pleasure from sex when using condoms. The internal migrants had no difficulty obtaining condoms, but the external migrants often found it difficult to go outside in the middle of the night for fear of being abused by the police. And lastly, we found that while friends discouraged condom use during sex, during their concurrent sex practices, the internal migrants were more likely to use condoms, but that their use were inversely correlated with the cleanliness or the presumed cleanliness of the girls that they were being with. So external migrants said things like, you know, and when they discuss condom use, like, what is the best way what is the best way of smelling a flower, with an open mouth or the, we're using a gas mask? That's how they thought about condom use. They also talked about it was too dangerous to go outside. things like that. And there's also this idea that to be masculine or to be marred, you have to have sex without a condom. For the internal migrants, they, for example, were looking to kind of guessing to see which girls were clean, and they were deciding whether to use condoms on that basis. Okay, and I'm told I only have 1 minute, so I'll be quick. This is a figure that we've gone through many iterations of to kind of conceptualize the similarities and differences in the social environment and HIV risk-related behavior between internal and external migrants. As you can see at the top, we looked at people who came from their home villages in Tajikistan and branched them out into two groups, one in Regar, which is the aluminum factory, the internal migrants, and the other who went to Moscow as external migrants. We found that both groups were away from their family, they had extra spending money, and they had variable HIV/AIDS knowledge. And these factors contributed to both extramarital sex and unprotected sex. And the differences in the two groups is that one, among the internal migrant group, they were registered workers in their own countries, they lived in dormitories with few others, whereas the external migrants had unsafe living conditions. They lived with many people in the construction sites or the bazaars. And for the internal migrants, this contributed to the sense of autonomy and choice. They had individual decision-making regarding sex, and they used condoms inversely related to the cleanliness of the presumed sex worker. The external migrants, on the other hand, were unprotected by law. They joined peer networks in response to these harsh living and working conditions, and they also had heavy alcohol use during their parties, and that these two factors contributed to both multiple sex partners and concurrent sex with sex workers, as well as a shared reluctance to use condoms. So our conclusions were basically that because there were differences in the social environment, that was definitely something that was true. They were unprotected by law, they were outsiders in an unfamiliar city, they had fear of police and skinhead, and they had unsafe living and working conditions for the external migrants. And although external migrants, this discourse on their safety focuses on being unprotected, we found that both external and internal migrants report regularly having unprotected sex with sex workers when working away from their homes. And for the both groups, that pleasure-seeking trumped self-protective behaviors despite the fact that internal migrants are registered workers in their own country and live in safe places. Thus, it appears that powerlessness alone does not explain HIV risk-taking. Furthermore, we found that other characteristics of the social environment appear to have an impact. For example, the external migrants' daily experiences are highly determined by group norms and behaviors in the face of harsh conditions. This includes things like having parties with heavy alcohol use, multiple sexual partners, concurrent sex with sex workers, and a shared reluctance to use condoms. In contrast, the internal migrants exercise individual decision-making regarding selecting the type of sex workers and the use of condoms. And so rather than emphasizing the sense of powerlessness, which does not appear to motivate men towards behavior change, HIV-related behaviors should be better conceptualized in terms of a spectrum of different social responses to harsh living and working conditions, and that, I'm almost finished, and that interventions aimed at this vulnerable mobile population should encourage the positive aspects of social identity and peer networks while discouraging high-risk behaviors such as unprotected group sex. And our intervention that we conceptualized was to do a peer-led training on three sessions on the train from Dushanbe to Moscow. It was a 5-day train ride, so we thought that this would be a good place to recruit migrant workers and to teach them how to protect themselves from HIV and to avoid risky behaviors. So this was piloted this summer and three sessions over three consecutive days. The first session talked about understanding risk factors that Tajik migrants faced in Moscow. The second is how migrants can protect themselves from HIV, and the third was how migrants can give and receive support from their family and peers, and we're currently analyzing the data from that intervention. So, thanks.